Welcome on to a Thursday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast, presented today by Betterment, whom you can find more about at betterment.com/capspaceurl. We're going to talk about another overtime game between Toronto and Miami, go over Cleveland's absolute record-setting demolition of the Hawks last night, and also get to what is quite a bit of news headed by the fact that Frank Vogel, in fact, will not be returning in Indiana. Joining me, as often, Dane LaRue.
Doesn't that crazy first quarter seem like a long time ago?
In the Heat-Raptors game, when they turned it over 11 times and gave up 8 steals?
Did it end up being 11 turnovers?
Yeah, 11 turnovers on, I think, 23 possessions. It was a 48% turnover rate in the first quarter.
Unbelievable. Yeah, because I tweeted it when it was 10 turnovers and 11 field goal attempts.
Yeah, it was... It didn't turn out too great for Miami, and they certainly have quite a bit to look back on in this game as things that they could have done better. So do the Raptors. I think maybe even everyone within a 300-mile radius of this game could probably point to some things that could have been done better, frankly.
Yeah, and Norman Powell, so he played the first 4 minutes, then he didn't come back in until the second half, right?
Yeah. They started him, they went immediately to Corey Joseph, which actually worked out pretty well to help them get back into it. Powell only played really as a defensive replacement after starting the second half in the Luis Scola ceremonial Toronto starting and never coming back in role. But I think probably the biggest thing to start with for this one with me is that it was about possessions. We talked about the turnovers, obviously. The other part, too, was that Jonas Valanciunas was able to turn around his effort on the offensive glass from game one when he had zero offensive rebounds. Toronto had 4 as a team. He ended this one with 6 offensive rebounds, and Toronto had 13 as a team. And combined with the turnover advantage, which was 21-9 in favor of Toronto, that allowed the Raptors to take 14 more shots and 13 more free throws than the Heat and defeat them despite being outshot by a substantial margin.
And they needed every one of those free throws because they went 14 of 26 from the line.
Oh, yeah, man. I mean, we can sort of put in all the things about this game that, and, you know, I know East fans look like these are dramatic games. They are not well-played games. They are not good games. And probably the biggest stat that indicates that for me was that Toronto took 24 shots in the last 4 seconds of the shot clock, and the Heat took 15. That is just a ton of standing around and not doing anything at all on offense for just massive periods of this game. To have 39 shot attempts taken in the last 4 seconds of the shot clock in this game is just mind-boggling.
And that's 4 seconds. I mean, that's a really narrow window. Even if you got it with 4 left, that's, you know, like a pump fake and a dribble or two, and then you're probably in.
Yeah, it is. And it's not so much as like, all right, you're always going to have some of those possessions where you're working the ball around. I mean, like the Jazz, for example, have a ton of passes, and they still, you know, were up at the top of the league for most shots taken down the end of the shot clock. But both of these teams, they're not running like complex stuff that's taking forever to develop. It's just, you know, one guy backing down. It's we're not starting until there's 10 on the shot clock. I mean, it really is just remarkable how many possessions on both sides just had nothing happen until the final 10 seconds of the shot clock. And I just don't understand why that.
And while I'm not deliberately trying to skip forward, the moment in that I think best reflected it was the lack of urgency Kyle Lowry had on the last possession of regulation, where they just didn't do, you know, he just moseyed on down the court. They had 10 seconds and he moseyed on down and they got it in the half court with about 5 seconds left. And then he took a bad three.
Yeah, Toronto, 4 of 18 on threes. You mentioned the 14 of 26 from the foul line, which was pretty miserable. They shot 42% overall. Kyle Lowry, 7 of 22, actually raised his playoff field goal percentage. He is now the first person in the shot clock era to have 9 straight playoff games shooting under 40% while taking 10 or more shots in each. That's from Micah Adams on Twitter. Great stat there. Lowry did look more confident. He got up 22 attempts at least in this one, and they need him to take those shots. But he had 6 assists. He was more aggressive, especially in the first half. But man, it is just really, really rough for Toronto's backcourt. DeMar DeRozan, 9 out of 24, 2 of 8 from the foul line.
And John Schumann's stat on the early part of the game I thought was notable, that Toronto had 18 points on 12 possessions off live ball turnovers. That's 1.5 points per possession. and they had 52 points on 58 possessions otherwise, which is distinctly not good.
So let's say you have two players on your team, both of whom are shooting under 40% for the playoffs by a substantial margin. And let's say you have another player who, going against the other team's player most susceptible to foul trouble, seems to score every time he gets the ball in a scoring position. Clearly your response would be to never throw it to him, right?
Yeah, he was it five post-ups in regulation?
Yeah, he had five post-ups. He scored on three of them. He had one ugly attempt at a pump fake where that Whiteside laughed at him because he then just threw up some crap. And then he had one play where he threw it out, and I think Damari Carroll was able to get fouled on that play. So totally effective for Valanciunas on his post-ups. Hassan Whiteside, not a guy who, because part of the problem with Valanciunas is everyone always says, oh, throw it to him. But, you know, he's not that quick. Like, quicker guys can kind of get around him. They can front, and, you know, it can be hard to get him the ball. Against Miami, when he's being guarded by Whiteside, Whiteside is not high energy enough or strong enough to push him off the block or front him and prevent the pass from going in, especially if you throw it to him right away. And most of the time, you know, he wasn't really, like, demanding the ball necessarily. They were running pick and roll on pretty much every possession. But at the very least, running that pick and roll early and then getting him into a post-up could be good. There are a couple times he had a deep seal and didn't get the ball as well, where he just got looked off as well. But and at least he was motivated to go and get the ball on the offensive rebound, perhaps by never getting it in the post. But, I'm not someone who thinks that, oh, yeah, like, post-ups are a panacea. I usually wouldn't point to that. But he was effective when he got the ball, especially because having Whiteside in foul trouble can be such a big deal. And also, it's not like the other offense was working so incredibly well. Like, without Valanciunas, there's only one other guy on the whole team who shot over 50%, and that was Carroll.
Yeah, and Carroll was barely over because he was 7-13 from the field. And it also takes some of the strain off of DeRozan and Lowry and hopefully would encourage them to take some of the worst shots out of their repertoire. You know, it's not going to be a perfect distribution. It's just not going to happen. But it has those two big spillover effects. One is that, you know, it can improve the quality of possessions just on the aggregate, the EV. And as you said, I feel like there's a decent chance of Whiteside fouling there. You know, he's not as disciplined enough to just make it through every time. You know, that's not to say that he'll foul all the time, but if you give him five extra post-ups and you get one extra foul, that makes four potentially, you know, let's say 10 more possessions of Blanco. That's a big deal.
What did you think of the play on which Dragic ended up getting the stitches and was called for a blocking foul at the same time?
I thought it was a bad call for a couple reasons. One of them is that there wasn't any body contact between Dragic and DeRozan. The body contact,
other than, unless you're counting the elbow,
yeah, exactly.
Part of the body.
Like,
yeah, no, I know what you mean, right? Like,
so I mean,
yeah.
If you're,
the only contact was him fouling DeRozan's elbow with his face, apparently.
Yeah, and leading to his teeth going through his lip or whatever.
I think he got eight stitches in total.
I don't think he lost a tooth this time, though, so that's an upgrade.
Yeah, and Ethan Skolnick in particular has been leading the charge that Dragic just gets no respect at all from the refs. He was in foul trouble for a lot of the game, too. He only ended up playing 35 minutes in this overtime game, and he was pretty awesome with 20 points on 13 shooting possessions and four assists. And really, the only time this game had any flow for either team was when they had their point guard in there running the offense with some of the reserves, especially for the Heat at the start of the fourth quarter. Things actually looked really good for them. And then, you know, Dragic, 8 of 12. Joe Johnson and Dwayne Wade, a combined 15 for 39 in this one. So that's another sort of perhaps inefficient allocation of resources in this game, especially down the end, too. Dragic only took two shots. You know, he'd been killing it. He had a bucket and two assists right before Wade came back in, and then Dragic took two shots. One was that tying three-pointer that was a catch-and-shoot, and then he had a meaningless layup at the end in the overtime, like once things were already out of reach. But he did get a couple of bad fouls, bad in the sense that he shouldn't have committed them. One was just he got slightly ahead of someone near half court and then decided to veer back into his path and got called for an offensive foul that I love, where a guy is just, you know, you veer in front of someone who's just trying to run up the court and draw a foul call. I hate that. And then the other one was just like a really stupid charge attempt. And, you know, I we've said this many times, but the league would probably be a little better off if they didn't encourage all of their players to just jump in front of other players and fall down. You know, they might get a few less injuries in that situation. But that was a thought, too. Another thing that I thought worked really well for the Heat in this one, especially early on, their big adjustment was early in the possession to have a small set of screen, basically for whoever the ball handler was. Oftentimes it would be whoever DeRozan was guarding, or just to get like a quick miscommunication if it was whoever was guarding Dragic, whatever. Like if Dragic or Wade would get screens from Johnson or Wade or Deng, and they're able to do that sort of in transition right at the beginning of the play and get really good stuff off of it. I think they did it, especially in the first quarter when they shot extremely well, other than the turnovers. I think they got like four straight buckets out of plays that began with that action. So that was a nice adjustment. They didn't go to it as much, I think, as time went on. But it's something to note that Spo inserted for this one that worked
and
well.
And it wasn't the first time in the playoffs that has worked really well. If, for those who remember, the Clippers did that to great effect against Portland to try to get Lillard back on Chris Paul.
Yeah, this was a little different from that because that was kind of a late game. We're going to kind of pound it down, and we're going to then do that to let it run, you know, to run the clock down, you know, it's and run your full play. This was happening. I thought it was so effective because it was happening in sort of a more chaotic situation early in the clock, and it wasn't just, okay, hey, you run all the way up here and set it. We know it's coming. Get ready. It was more, hey, you're kind of dribbling up the wing. All right, come up. Just step up and set a quick screen for me, you know, before we do whatever it is else that we're going to do. And I thought it was really, really effective. A couple other things. Terrence Ross actually had his second straight pretty decent game. He had some key hoops late as well, 10 points on 5 of 11. Not incredibly efficient, but he also had the first two defensive rebounds of his career. We can congratulate him on that. But he also, I mean, the biggest thing was he didn't really get taken advantage of too badly defensively, and he ended up playing 28 minutes, getting a lot of Powell's minutes. And while I generally prefer Powell over Ross, he's probably been better than Powell in these first two.
And something else, we talked about it briefly earlier, but I think it warrants special mention, is that when Powell was struggling early, they went very quickly to Corey Joseph, and I thought he played very well.
Yeah, he did. He guarded Wade pretty well, and you'd think that maybe that's too much of a size mismatch. We did not really see, actually, Wade go to his straight post-ups on the block. I might, if Joseph is going to be on him for big minutes, I think they might want to go to that because he, I think, has more of an advantage on Joseph in those situations where he can just bump him back and get to his floater. Valanciunas, not the kind of big who's going to come over and block that kind of a shot in the air, and if he does, he can find Whiteside on the alley-oop. So Joseph, when Wade was handling the ball in pick and roll, is probably by far their best pick and roll defender. So I thought he did a pretty decent job on Wade down the end of the game, although Wade was able to get a few buckets.
Oh, and hey, they reanimated, I guess would be the right word for it, Mr. The Johnson to counteract Joe Johnson.
Yeah, James Johnson actually played a little bit and did a pretty decent job on Joe Johnson.
Fine.
Joe only ended up 8 out of 22, had a couple of misses, wasn't able to get going that much against him. They also put Patterson on Joe Johnson a little bit, and Joe not quite as good as he was 2 years ago when he killed the Raptors. I think they will certainly take 8 out of 22 for him. And also, if Johnson is in there, the Heat basically have zero chance of getting out in transition, because it's amazing to say this for an NBA wing, he actually like cannot sprint. Like he just can't do it. Like it's not like something that he physically can do any longer. And it's pretty amazing that he's as good as he is when he's not able to like do a full out sprint down the court. But like, you know, whoever he's guarding, can, if he just runs as fast as he can, like Joe Johnson will be like 5 steps behind him by the end of the play if it's a transition play. So in any event, you know, let's get down to the end of the game. We can get into some of the other kind of larger themes through the prism of the end. The Heat basically didn't score for three and a half minutes down the end. It wasn't necessarily because Toronto was playing so well. Like they had a miscommunication on a pick and roll with Deng where DeRozan thought there was a switch. He ended up leaving Deng wide open for a three at the top. Was lucky he missed that. Gerald Green, you remember that play when he got Terrence Ross in the air. He could have gotten a three-shot foul and just for whatever reason didn't actually take the shot. His pump fake worked and Ross was flying right to him and he just gave it up to Wade, got it back, and then missed a short jumper. So Toronto was able to just inexorably crawl back into it after trailing by 6-80-74. But their offense really was not too impressive down the end either.
Yeah, it was just such a strange game in that sense where I didn't think that the execution was that horrible either way. It just wasn't that well played. I don't know if people understand that difference.
I thought it was really bad personally. There are major mistakes or like outright bad offense happening on I think virtually every possession.
But was it bad execution or was it just like the bad strategy?
Well, I guess it all goes into that, right? I mean,
if you want to count it together, then it does.
Yeah, it is really mystifying to me. I would love to know what's going on in these Raptors huddles. I mean, are they being instructed to just wait until there's 12, 10 on the shot clock before they get any player movement at all? Is Casey saying go ahead and they're just, you know, they're not executing that? I really don't know how it is that this keeps happening for them to just not start. Do they just not even have enough options to their plays to where you're just going to run out of stuff to do after 7 or 8 seconds? So you might as well just start with 7 or 8 seconds. I'm loathe to kill coaches on stuff like this, but even the Thunder, you know, at least the Thunder get going fast. You know, they don't just pound the ball for incredibly long on a lot of these possessions. Even if it is a simple action, you want to give that a chance to work and then at least move the ball around once you've created the initial opening and there's help, and they don't even give themselves time to do that.
Yeah, and one of the best examples of that was one of the kind of early plays in this crunch time period was when the Raptors basically down 2 points, down 80-78, held the ball basically for 9 seconds. Ross gets it.
It was after a timeout,
too. And then Ross finally gets it, and they fortunately he's able to put it in the net to tie it at 80.
Yeah, the play that they ran was just a pin down for Ross to go out to the wing, and then he got a pick and roll with Valanciunas. And before they did that, Kyle Lowry just dribbled the ball up at the top of the key for 9 seconds. Like, they had like 16 on the shot clock when they inbounded the ball. It was just, I couldn't believe it. And then they just got lucky because Whiteside, and what became a theme, you know, I'm sure he generally likes to stay back. He's probably instructed even to stay back early in the clock. But late in the clock, when there's like 2-3 seconds left, you have to step up. Because giving up an open two out of the pick and roll on those situations is just, you know, if you just step up, you take that away, and then there's no time for them to do anything else. So you're basically, you know, you're not going to get beat behind you at that point. You might as well get out there and challenge that shot. And so this is the first time he didn't do that. Ross just snaked right to the elbow and shot. I think part of the reason why Whiteside was loath to do that was because these plays were in pick and rolls with Valanciunas, and Valanciunas had been effective on the offensive glass. So I think he was trying to, you know, more concerned about boxing out Valanciunas than actually stopping the initial shot. But late clock, you got to just trust your teammates on that play. You know, if you're doing your job, you're going to get blamed when Valanciunas gets offensive rebounds, but you just have to have the confidence that your teammates will take care of it and that, you know, it's not your fault, it's theirs if they can't get the rebound. And that's part of what makes the pick and roll so difficult. You know, if there's a good offensive rebounding big, it gives them a free shot most of the time to the offensive glass if you are going to defend the ball handler properly. But, you know, you just got to deal with that. If you're Whiteside, and just time and again, he, in the late clock, let guys just shoot wide open jumpers.
Yeah, it is a problem just in terms of mentality that I think can be corrected with time, but probably not this season. So then go down, the game is tied, and Isolation Joseph gets a possession on Damari Carroll, and Carroll, I thought, did a really nice job defensively and just basically created a really tough shot.
Yeah, a shot that was, of course, preceded by a pump fake. These two teams, between Lowry, DeRozan, Johnson, and Wade, may have set a record for most pump fakes outside of 2 feet from the basket in NBA history, and it was awful. It was so awful. The next time down, DeRozan goes to the baseline and does a pump fake, and, you know, nobody goes for it, obviously. I mean, the Raptors, I think, probably did 100 pump fakes in this game, and once it got bit on on a Valanciunas post-up, where, you know, that's where it might actually work. You know, if you're really close to the basket, a pump fake might actually work to get a guy out of position. He scored on it. But and part of the reason it's so galling is that when you pump fake, generally when someone drives, they are, you're creating somewhat of a help situation. You're at least having a guy take a couple of steps towards you. Well, once you put two hands on the ball and you pump fake, you've now created a situation where you, where the help defense knows that you are no longer a threat. You either are going to shoot it from right there or you're going to pass it, and they immediately go back to their men. And so when that happens, you now have no opening to pass it. If you have pump faked, you've now wasted 2 seconds. You're not getting the foul call. They're just, Miami's defenders are way too disciplined to fall for that. And now you can't, not only can you not throw it to someone who will have an opening themselves, but you, it's sometimes it's even hard to find someone at all. You could waste another 2, 3, 4 seconds just trying to find someone at all who can even get open, because you can now just start denying people. It really causes the offense to grind to a halt. Whereas if you just drove and then just threw a pass immediately instead of pump faking, you might be able to get it to a guy who now is going to be able to catch the ball with the defense closing out to him and be able to do something. So for your 1 in 100 chance that they're going to bite on your pump fake for this 20-foot jump shot when you're not even facing the basket, you're giving up any chance for your teammate to get an advantage. And it was just so galling and frustrating for me to see that from both sides, but especially, I mean, Toronto, DeRozan and Lowry, every time they pick up their dribble, it's a pump fake. It was just killing me.
Yeah, it was. It wasn't the most satisfying thing in the world. But that possession, they ended up. It ended up being that DeRozan took a decently contested two, and for the second time in 2 games in crunch time, Waldang got called for a foul by basically blocking DeRozan's ability to land.
Yeah, DeRozan finally. It was actually a perfect example of what I was talking about. Lowry had to like run out to him and was like barely able to even catch the ball. He was able to hand it back off to DeRozan, who, to his credit, at least started moving again once he passed it. But you know, it wasn't a good shot. It was very well contested, and it just so happened that Deng jumped forward a little too much. It was a good call, but of course, DeRozan, continuing the high quality theme of this game, missed 2 free throws.
God, Eastern Conference people are going to be so pissed at us. But it was terrible.
Hey, the Cavs were great last night.
We'll get there eventually.
Good basketball. I will say it's good basketball. It's dramatic. We're talking about it. You know, we're not. I'm not like, hey, I'm not going to watch this game. So then, Valanciunas, continuing what was a rough last few minutes from Whiteside, was able to push him right under the rim. It was unbelievable play by Valanciunas. Take nothing away from him. Because Luol Deng actually, you know, what the strategy is on those plays is the two guys on the side where there are two defensive players pinch the guy, which was Valanciunas, and then someone from the three-point line comes in and boxes out the shooter. Well, he beat both of those guys, Deng and Whiteside. He actually expertly held Whiteside's arm down with his left hand and then was able to just get 2 tips at it with his right, the second of which went in, and that put Toronto up by 82-80.
Yeah, and as you mentioned during the game itself, that's why it's good to keep your hands up, or at least not all the way down when you're boxing out, because that way it's easier to tell if you're being held.
Yeah, and also just keep your hands free so that, you know, the ball can, you can grab it with 2 hands. Whiteside went for one. He only was able to get a slight tip on it, and then that's how Valanciunas got his second tip. Miami then went to a Wade high pick and roll. Corey Joseph got a really nice contest. It looked like Wade actually kind of had him on his back, and it would have been maybe behooved him to take another dribble in and see if he could find Whiteside, force a little bit more help from Valanciunas, but instead he went to the fadeaway, a shot that he can hit, but it was a tough shot. Joseph got a nice contest on him. And then the next time down, Toronto, of course, bled the air out of the ball, which makes a little bit more sense now, under a minute left, up 2. And they then ran a pretty simple pick and roll, Lowry and Valanciunas, and Lowry was able to get wide open and shoot the shot. And afterwards, you saw Dragic turn to Whiteside, motion towards his chest, and say, you could read his lips, he said, get up, get up. So great play next time down for Miami. Wade crosses over, rejects the screen on Joseph. Joseph said he blamed himself that he should have been up on him. I don't know what he really was supposed to do, because you're up 4, but with 2, you know, with Miami in a situation to get a 2-for-1, you shouldn't necessarily be in no threes defense there. You know, a 2 hurts you almost as bad as a 3 does. So the fact that Wade crossed over and hit that, I don't think that Joseph necessarily did anything wrong. It was just a tough shot by Wade. Great move. And he is now 4-of-5 on threes after missing 21 straight since December.
Yeah, he's finally earning the 3 nickname again.
So the Heat then had the exact same mistake as the time before through Whiteside, where Lowry, it was a little bit more excusable.
Wait,
this time.
Wait, before
Lowry,
we get into the play, can we talk about the personnel issue with this play? Because this is Toronto's last possession of regulation before the garbage last one, right?
Yeah. So, yeah, they had Dragic and Joe Johnson on the floor on this one. And then, you know, they called timeout once Lowry scored and they were down three. It could be that they figured they were just going to go afterwards once they were down one. You know, if they got a stop, they were just going to push it. And that's why you leave Dragic and Joe Johnson on the floor. They ended up calling timeout down three, maybe thinking, all right, you know, we got to drop a play for a three and we got to make sure everyone knows that we need a three. But, yeah, if they had planned to call timeout the whole time, then they probably should have gotten guys like Winslow and Josh Richardson in there instead of Dragic and Joe Johnson. Of course, they probably could have just anticipated that Lowry was going to do a pick and roll with Valanciunas, but it was, of course, Dragic on there. He got picked off. He's not the best defensive player. You know, Josh Richardson certainly probably would have done a better job on that than he did. And then Whiteside on the rescreen did not get up again as well. This time it was even more obvious that he sort of backed off to go box out Valanciunas, and you saw Dragic turn to him again and be like, didn't I just tell you to get up here? We just did this play the last time. You understand why Whiteside can be so frustrating. I mean, that's one thing if a young player makes a mistake, but if you then repeat that same mistake on the very next possession, that's really has to be galling for some of the Heat players and coaches.
Especially because they generally do such a good job executing, but any not even a weak link in the chain, but any mistake like that creates the opportunity that made the basket.
So then the Heat went with five smalls. They took Whiteside out. Before that, though, Casey had had both Valanciunas and DeRozan in the game with no Corey Joseph. He finally put in Joseph for Valanciunas when the Heat brought in all their smalls. I don't know why he wouldn't have gone with Biombo in that circumstance up three if you're going to have a big on the floor. And if I were actually Miami, I think I even said this last time, like I probably would have preferred to have Valanciunas on the floor just as a guy who's not going to be able to switch. If you screen for someone with Whiteside, net, you know, you can probably get an open three on Valanciunas. But as it turned out, their play worked out great anyway. It was just a pretty easy pick and roll with Joe Johnson and Dragic. And Damari Carroll and Corey Joseph just completely messed up the coverage. Joseph switched. I don't know whether what they were supposed to do was switch, but there was plenty of time to see that Joseph had switched on to Joe Johnson. Carroll then, just for whatever reason, retreated to the nail, which is, you know, right the center of the free throw line, instead of just going to Goran Dragic, and then Joe Johnson just threw it back to Dragic, and he was wide open, and he drained a three to tie the game, setting up another masterful play call at the end.
Well, and it was weird for me because I believe it was this call where DeRozan was still in, and I was just sitting there going, well, why is DeRozan in? And then he wasn't involved at all in how the play got completely botched.
Yeah, well, at that point, once you've put in Joseph and taken out Valanciunas, really your only other option to put in at that point, I guess you could say maybe Patterson.
Or James Johnson.
But, well, and James Johnson is too spacey. You don't want him out there at the end of game situation. The reason he doesn't play at all is because he just screws up too much defensively. So I'm not relying on him. If the reason you don't play a guy is because they make mental errors late, they make mental errors, you don't want to play him on a last possession like that, especially if he hasn't been in the flow of the game. I totally understand that aspect of it, at least. Maybe you could say Patterson. Not too egregious once they actually got Joseph in. When they were going to stay big, yeah, you should have Joseph in for DeRozan instead, especially because it wasn't like DeRozan was even hitting his free throws either. So then the last play, I think there was like 10 seconds left. Toronto, in a move that I actually don't mind, elects to take the ball full court. You know, that's sort of been something that coaches have done on occasion. Most notably, Michael Jordan in game three of the 91 finals hit a game-tying shot, bringing the ball fully down court. You can get some momentum up. But, of course, they didn't do that. They brought it up as slowly as possible. And Lowry decided to start going with about 3 seconds left. He had Josh Richardson on him. They had called timeout, so, of course, the Heat were able to get their defensive guys in. Richardson, maybe given the way he's defended this year, maybe one of the top 10 guys in the league I would want, you know, at 6'5 with incredibly quick feet and great intensity athleticism, that I would want defending a point guard just trying to straight up ISO at the end of a game. Lowry, not really a guy who does ISOs hardly at all. He operates nearly exclusively in pick and roll. And yet that was the play call. I get that you want to make sure you run the clock down. I'm a big proponent of that. That's what the math says. I also get that such possessions generally are converted at about a 30% rate, although part of that could be because such ridiculous play calls have been made over the years in those situations. But yeah, it's just, it was terrible. Like, there's no two ways about it, and he never penetrated closer to the basket than about 27 feet, and I think he just, did he just airball that short? Is that what
happened? I think he airballed it short. And what was so frustrating and galling to me about this, as it was even to me worse than the horrible, horrible Jeff Teague one at the end of regulation against Boston. I think that was in game 4 or game 5. Because at least on the Teague one, Atlanta tried something and failed. And then so that was kind of like their fail thing.
Yeah. And he also, it was Jeff Teague against Isaiah Thomas. It wasn't Kyle Lowry against Josh Richardson.
Yeah, it was infuriating. And to see when, and considering that the game before, Miami had just smoked them in overtime. So you're sitting there going, you know, this is your best chance. It's not your only chance, but it's your best chance. And to do almost nothing with it is insane.
I mean, obviously, I didn't like the play call. I think there's a ton of other things. I think that Dwayne Casey, in general, is a good coach. I think he is at least average or above. I think that to get 55 wins out of this team, I think that they've generally overachieved beyond what their talent level is the last 3 years with him in command. But I didn't like the play call. I mean, if you're worried about running the clock down, and there's a ton of things that you could do, right? What if you, and this is actually the Blazers are doing this, and the Raptors should do more of this because Hassan Whiteside is not going to get around a screen. What if you just have a wing screen for Valanciunas to knock Whiteside off, and then you come up and have Valanciunas set a screen? Or maybe if you're worried that that wing will just switch on to Valanciunas, you just have Valanciunas go up there and set the screen on his own anyway. Just have him set it with 4 seconds left, and fine. If Whiteside's going to double 25 feet out on the floor, okay, I guess you deal with that, but you're still probably get a better look. You could run pin downs on either side of the floor just to occupy the help defenders and give them something to think about. And then if neither of those guys goes open, then you could have Lowry try and drive it, or have him drive while the action's going on and everyone is distracted. You could just have Valanciunas set a back screen for Lowry coming up at half court with about 6 seconds left. You could do a pick and roll early on to get Dwayne Wade onto Lowry instead of Josh Richardson. There are a million things that you could at least try to do. And then Lowry, for his part, either. I mean, I thought his effort in trying to get a good shot wasn't any good either, right? I mean, he didn't ever try to drive. I mean, I guess he just was really worried about running the clock down. But there's no reason you can't just take that same step back from 19 feet instead of 26. I would hope, at least. So you go a little earlier, get him on his heels, and then see what you can do. Just waiting until the end, it was just so ugly all the way around, and a deserved consequence to have him airball the final shot.
Yeah, I don't think I really need to add anything to that.
In the overtime, then, Toronto's defense was excellent, and the Heat really didn't score at all, I don't think, until the very end.
Until a quick two in the last minute.
Yeah, although, again, I tweeted this out that neither of their quick twos bothered me because the initial play was for a three.
Right.
And on both of those plays. And Toronto just did a great job not giving up a three. And at that point, they didn't really have any prospects that could lead to any kind of a decent look from three coming up. The two presented itself. One was a dunk from Dang. The other one was an easy layup from Dragic with nobody home at the rim. So at that point, enough time has gone by that you just have to take the two. I was fine with that. What kills me is just when the initial play is for the quick two. So they tried for the three. It wasn't there. And you just, time's running out. You got to do something. Like, I totally understand. It was good D by Toronto in that situation. Any other thoughts on the overtime, really? I think that was about it. Toronto actually hit a few free throws in the overtime, hit a couple of tough shots, and Miami just was not able to get anything going. I mean, I think from their standpoint, just giving the ball to Dragic more is something that they really should have done. This game down the end was more what I kind of feared all season would be the case for the Heat. I mean, you remember in that early 15 and 60, we had the stat that Wade had a 38% usage in the last 5 minutes, and Dragic's was like 6% or something. Like, it was in the single digits. I can't remember what it was. And especially when Dragic had been having such success, when they don't have their best defender necessarily on him, when he's got the size advantage on Lowry, I think for all those reasons, I would have liked to at least let him get a few more looks.
And they were also feeding Joe Johnson when he wasn't really getting good looks, and he wasn't playing super well. And so, when a guy like that is rolling, then sure, you can do that. But otherwise, try to be a little bit more ambitious with it.
Yeah, and to the final kind of crunch time resume for Whiteside, really one of his worst efforts. And he was great in the first half, right? I mean, they really just were not challenging him. He got a couple of ridiculous blocks. But So Valanciunas had two buckets on offensive rebounds. He had another post-up bucket on him. Whiteside was charged with another loose ball foul immediately after not getting a defensive rebound that he could have been in position for. He missed two shots, one of which was a tip, which, you know, I don't mind that much. I mean, he at least got in position for the offensive rebound and a hook shot. He had another play in the overtime where he got a steal immediately followed by turning it over. And then he had that terrible pick and roll D on Lowry and Ross right down the end of regulation. And he also lost two jump balls to Valanciunas, one of which Valanciunas subtly fouled him on. But and he didn't score at all. So it was a pretty rough last 10 minutes of the game, including the overtime for Whiteside.
How is it that none of the other refs ever see it when a guy grabs the other guy's arm on a jump ball?
Yeah, it's weird, right?
I've only ever seen it get called, I think, once or twice this season, and it was so blatant where you couldn't miss it.
Yeah, Valanciunas is he's a jump ball master. Definitely knows all the tricks on that one. Let's get to Atlanta-Cleveland. But first of all, our friends at Betterment. Betterment is the future of automated investing. You can learn more about them at betterment.com/capspace. You just remember, we talk about Capspace all the time on the show. It's a URL for this one, betterment.com/capspace. They are the largest independent automated investing service out there, and they make it easier, more straightforward, and less expensive to invest with smarter cutting-edge technology to bring you sophisticated investing and financial advice. And the best part is it's all at a lower cost than more traditional financial services because it's automated. And more than 150,000 customers choose Betterment's advanced advice algorithms and their beautiful user interface to manage over $4 billion of their dollars. So this is the perfect time to get started with them. You can save for your retirement or other financial goals because Dunked On listeners can get up to 6 months of no fees at that betterment.com/capspace URL. Betterment.com/capspace, investing made better. So this was a complete evisceration, Atlanta and Cleveland, and they gave up 27 three-point attempts and a half, of which Cleveland made 18. They gave up 14 corner threes for the game. Cleveland took 45 three-point attempts. But to me, the far more salient fact, even than all of the offensive fireworks, you know, was that the score was 74-38 at halftime, and that 38 to me is a much bigger problem for Atlanta than the 74 even.
Yeah, because offense can come and go, but if you're not getting anything, that is something that can be larger systemic and also can be emblematic of a really bad effort, which I think was also a major factor in this game.
Yeah, it was. And obviously Atlanta, once the train really got rolling, especially towards the last 5 minutes or so of the first half, they really kind of checked out and were just giving up a ton of corner threes. But and some of those were from shooters that they are okay letting shoot. James was four out of six. J.R. Smith hit some crazy ones, but Irving was four out of five. You know, a lot of those are off the dribble too. Shots that you to a certain extent have to live with. And James also became really difficult to deal with because when he's hitting his jump shot, we've talked about how he can't drive to the basket. Well, a big part of that is because guys can just lay off him and don't have to respect his jumper. Once someone like Millsap, who was guarding him most of the game, has to get up on that jumper, now James still can blow right by him just with a straight line hard drive. Millsap doesn't have the quickness when he doesn't already have that cushion to lay off him. So that's a major problem. We'll see if James continues hitting his threes. You know, he hasn't up until this game, but he also had another three steals. I think he had four in game one, so that was huge. But really, just the bigger problem is, like, how is Atlanta supposed to score on these guys? I mean, just if I'm going to ask you that question, like, what is your bread and butter that you can count on as the Atlanta Hawks to get buckets against this team?
I'm not sure that they have one. You know, they don't have guys who can create really one-on-one. I love Paul Millsap. It's just I don't think that's what he's best at. And their perimeter guys aren't particularly adept at that. I mean, Dennis Schroeder isn't going to hit the shots like he hit in game one. You know, that was aberrational in that way. One of my favorite stats in this game, and of course there are a lot of them, is that Atlanta attempted less twos than Cleveland attempted threes and made less of them as well.
That's bad.
It's real bad. Like, so Atlanta was 19 of 44 from two, and Cleveland was 25 of 45 from three.
Yeah, that 25, a record, of course, as I'm sure everyone listening to this knows already, a record for regular season or postseason. And the 18, obviously, same thing with that in the first half. They were three short of the playoff record after the first half was over, which is pretty unbelievable. And meanwhile, the Hawks combined to shoot 2 of 11 from 3, which is not enough attempts and not enough makes, obviously, either. It was
They were 2 of 11 in the first half. They ended up 11 of 27.
Yeah.
In an entire half of garbage time.
Yeah, thank you. But yeah, it was I mean, if you're Atlanta, right, you would say, oh, maybe we can attack Kevin Love in pick and roll, right? He's guarding Al Horford. Well, they're just going under on the pick and roll. And those guys don't have the size to really take advantage of going under on the pick and roll, like, say, someone, or the craft, frankly, someone like Dwayne Wade does, right? Like, Wade can work to his shot and shoot a 15-footer, which he can actually make. You know, both Schroeder and Teague kind of shoot these set shots, so they're not really as comfortable pulling up from, like, 15-foot, where there might be a little bit more of a contest. They're not going to hit threes when they go under. Worst case, they can just switch it, and Atlanta has not been able to score out of that. Paul Millsap going one-on-one against Tristan Thompson, able to get absolutely nothing going against him at all. Millsap at least did have 16 points in the first half. He got fouled a lot, but he still is not going to be, you know, he had 16 of their 38 points. Nobody else had anything going. Korver, they're just, he took five twos in the first half. You know, they're kind of making him go back to Irving. He's still only two out of six.
Mike Scott.
Couldn't even get a shot attempt because they're just, you know, they're not, the pick and roll just isn't creating openings. And then what's worse, when the Hawks do get open threes, their shooters, other than Korver, and even Korver took a step back this year, just aren't reliable enough. You know, I mean, Cleveland's three-point shooters, they have guys who are going to knock shots down. You know, Kyrie is going to knock shots down. J.R. Smith is a 40% three-point shooter this year. Love is probably, you know, a better shooter from three than anyone on the Hawks roster who isn't named Korver. Matthew Dellavedova is an awesome spot-up three-point shooter. Richard Jefferson is an awesome spot-up three-point shooter. Channing Frye is an awesome spot-up three-point shooter. And the Hawks don't have probably anyone who's as good of a spot-up three-point shooter other than Korver as those, like, six dudes that I just named.
It's definitely concerning, not only for this playoff series, which I think both of us feel is not over, but, you know, functionally, but for them long-term, because they don't have the kind of financial flexibility to add those guys when the market is going to go haywire like we know it will.
Yeah, and another thing that I started thinking about is, you know, if the Hawks are going to keep getting completely demoralized in this series, and, you know, they really, it seemed like mentally were struggling after this one, as I would be too. I mean, this team, they have a ton of bad blood with them, first of all, so they really hate them. Number one, I mean, going back to last year's series and all the Dellavedova stuff, you know, breaking Korver's ankle and then the flagrant with Horford and, you know, so there's that aspect of it. Then there's the fact that they have now lost 10 straight to this team, including the regular season. And some of the quotes afterwards about how, oh, yeah, they were like, you know, breaking unwritten rules by gunning for the three-point record and it wasn't classy. And, you know, Dante Jones, who hit the three, is like, yeah, I took two wide-open corner threes. Like, what are you talking about? And he hit the one that set the record. So, I mean, this has got to be really deflating for the Hawks. If they can't win game three, you have to imagine there's no way they rally and win game four. And regardless, you know, they just seem so far away from having even remotely solved this team. There are just so many issues, which we've talked about. So now, Al Horford, a free agent at the end of the year. The Hawks have historically been a financially conservative operation. They do not seem like the sort that's just going to offer him the 5-year max, which no matter what happened, that's probably enough to get him to stay. It's so much money. But if they do not offer that to him and they say, hey, you know, well, how about, you know, 4 years, $80 million? Now you're getting to the point where the money is going to be, could be equal somewhere else. Atlanta's got plenty of money. They're considered to be in the mix. Maybe Boston, you know, the Bulls even could be another potential option. There are a ton of places, obviously, that he could go. You start to wonder if this team doesn't look like it's one that can be remotely competitive with this Cavaliers team that is not so unbelievable. I mean, they won 56 games or something. Is he going to look to leave?
And a major factor for Atlanta, for Horford, too, is that outside of him, basically everybody's a free agent the next year. So you run into the issue that a couple of guys are going to have big decisions on the summer of, am I going to commit to a place where I don't know who my teammates are going to be a couple of years from now, especially as a lot of these players are hitting the early 30s. So he's making a very different commitment now than, let's say, he was when he signed his rookie extension.
That's true, too. Another thing that we should note, too, that's got to be demoralizing is, in the first half, Cleveland had 9 offensive rebounds to 13 defensive rebounds for the Hawks. And that's in addition to, you know, 18 out of 27 three-point shooting. So you're taking nothing away at all. And when on the rare occasions that they do miss, you're giving up an offensive rebound nearly half the time. Tristan Thompson, of course, bedeviled them, as did Love, who is a great offensive rebounder in his own right. He had 3 offensive rebounds in the first half, and Thompson had 4. I think that for this team structurally, you know, we've talked about how they don't, we're talking about the Hawks now, they don't have a ton of athleticism. Al Horford has been playing out of position at center his entire career. When he first started, he was undersized. Most teams had a traditional center that, you know, could maybe go after him in the post a little bit. The game kind of evolved around him to where he actually kind of has more of an advantage offensively, but he still just is not a good enough defensive rebounder at the center position, especially when you have small guys all around him. You know, Teague, Korver does a decent enough job rebounding for his physical gifts, but those are limited. Bazemore is just kind of a skinny, you know, he's not really a small forward. And then Millsap used to be a great rebounder. Now he's pretty average for a power forward. So I think it's Al, if I were him, might be thinking, all right, maybe it's time for me to like actually play as a full-time power forward somewhere. The problem with that is he may now be slowing down enough that he won't be quick enough to play power forward anymore. But, you know, it's this Hawks team as it is built is just not a contender. And, you know, that reality, whether it's through Horford leaving or not, is something that may have to be faced at some point. But, you know, they at least have inspired a renaissance in Hawks basketball, and they're getting to the second round, you know, more years than not in this last, you know, 10-year period or so.
Yeah, and some of that goes back to the idea of defining success. I mean, I think that to a point, this has been a really nice run for them. And yeah, it was a little bit disappointing last year when they had such a great record and then got knocked out so kind of viciously by Cleveland in the conference finals. But, you know, they've been more relevant than this franchise has been basically ever. But the problem is, even that has an expiration date. And so this isn't necessarily the time to think about it, but I mentioned this about a week ago and got a lot of crap for it. But if Al Horford leaves, they have to seriously think about trading some of those guys who are going to be pending free agents, because if they leave of their own volition, then the Hawks are basically a blank canvas, and that's terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, maybe you see what you can replace them with. You know, I know they have a lot of confidence in their coaching staff. They have a lot of confidence in, and this is probably going on too long for a postmortem when a team hasn't even been eliminated yet, but it sure seems pretty unlikely that that'll change. So yeah, we'll just talk about that later at some point when we get into their off-season preview. Let's get some news. Frank Vogel is out, as some reporting and then Larry Bird's comments had augured earlier in the week. Bird did not meet with Vogel, but actually called him in the morning, and apparently he said at the press conference that Frank tried to talk him out of it and might have even gotten close, but he did not succeed in that. And so we've kind of talked about, like, already on some previous episodes about, you know, whether he's a good coach or not. I think that he certainly is. I think he's going to be in demand. What is a little disturbing, we generally don't talk about sort of these rumored candidates, but here I think it's interesting. Why don't you run down the list? It is a little underwhelming.
Mike D'Antoni, Mark Jack.
Probably the best of the lot, and someone who would at least fit Bird's stated goal of getting better offensively, although Bird, I still maintain, is a little bit delusional in that, you know, he added a ton of players who are not efficient offensive players and expected them to be better offensively, which didn't really make much sense. But nonetheless, he says he wants to score more points, get better. I think D'Antoni could at least help with that.
Former Pacer, Mark Jackson.
Mark Jackson is not who I would look towards to play smaller or install a freer flowing offense. This is the man who started Festus Ezeli and Andres Biedrins next to each other in a playoff series against the Spurs, and never played Draymond Green at the four. Started Jermaine O'Neal against the Clippers in 2014, when if they had just started Draymond earlier, maybe they could have actually you know, won that series even without Andrew Bogut. Not the guy I would be looking for, and you know, for a number of reasons, you know, I think his Golden State tenure is not particularly impressive in terms of what he might do for especially a team like this. You know, I think you could say, hey, he'll help us like develop some players, bring confidence to a young team, help change the culture. Those are really what's the good parts of Jackson's resume. So, you know, in like Phoenix or something, maybe he's someone who could make sense. But this is a team that feels like they have the players and is trying to take the next step with coaching that is going to be more effective offensively. Doesn't really ring a bell there. And same thing with another guy who's on there, Randy Whitman. So, he doesn't really, another guy who's not really an offensive guru and just, you know, I think is just kind of like a worse version of what Vogel was, basically.
And on the note of offensive gurus, Mike Woodson, Brian Shaw.
Yeah, Woodson resisted playing Carmelo at the four despite all the evidence of how good it was. He finally, against his own volition, did it, and they actually had a really good year in 2013 as a result of that. But then they moved on from him the next year. He was pretty ISO heavy in Atlanta. Not a guy that I feel like I would be like champing at the bit to give another chance to. And then Brian Shaw had what could only be termed a disastrous stint in Denver. Certainly someone who's been known. He was an assistant with the Pacers, with Vogel, before leaving for Denver. But, you know, another guy who there's no real evidence that he is a good NBA coach. So it's not like they're looking outside the box here. Maybe this reporting is wrong and there will be some other potential candidates, but it's not looking like, I mean, none of these guys, I mean, maybe D'Antoni, you could talk yourself into, could be an upgrade, at least offensively, on Vogel, but it's hard to see how any of the other ones could possibly be.
And Nate McMillan, I've heard his name tossed around, and while I think he has a better resume than all but one of those candidates, he doesn't bring what this team needs. I mean, it seems like Larry Bird, or the front office in general, is forgetting that this team was top 10 in defense and a little bit underwhelming on offense. Like, you look at this group of guys, and other than D'Antoni, none of them fit the bill of what you're looking for in terms of a fit. And it's shocking when you make the decision to let Frank Vogel go. You go, okay, well, you can do that if you make the right decision, just like the Warriors with Mark Jackson. You know, you can do that, but you need to make the right move. And while, of course, as you said, we don't know all of the candidates, it doesn't look great to me that they will hire a coach who is better than Frank Vogel.
Well, and Bird also said, hey, we think that with the assistant coaching staff that we have in place, they can help maintain the defense. But if you're going to bring in a quality new coach, you now want to impose an assistant on him. That doesn't really seem to make a ton of sense either. Another interesting thing to come out of this press conference was that Larry Bird said, oh, declining Solomon Hill's rookie option really was like a kick in his rear. And, you know, he told him that in the exit interviews. And, you know, we might still want him back. But, you know, hey, I guess it might cost us a lot more money. Well, no, actually, because you declined his rookie option, you are limited to offering him $2.3 million. So you can't actually pay him a lot more money, and you are going to lose him. That was a pretty big error for someone to make, you know, a GM to make in a press conference. Maybe it just slipped his mind. I don't want to give him the benefit of the doubt, but man, that is a pretty ugly, if he really thinks that, which I'll give him the benefit of the doubt and say he doesn't, but you still should have your head on straight well enough to not say that in a press conference and make yourself look that bad to just straight up get a rule wrong.
And even if we give him the benefit of the doubt, that is not the way that you give a talented guy a kick in the pants, because then you lose all of your ability to retain them if it works. So, you know, basically anything else you can do is better than that.
All right, let's get to a few more things here before we go. Vogel is supposed to interview in Houston. D'Antoni is also interviewed there. That is, you know, they're going to be doing a pretty broad search. It sounds like J.B. Bickerstaff has...
A search, sir.
Yes. Yeah, that was the tweet from Mark Stein. And J.B. Bickerstaff has probably wisely removed himself for consideration. It's hard to imagine that they would have wanted to bring him back after this year, and this will give him a jump on maybe getting some good assistant jobs elsewhere. So that seems to be his focus, and probably a smart move rather than waiting around for the 1 in 20 chance that they interview 19 other people after already being familiar with you intimately. And then, oh yeah, by the way, we'll circle back to you and hire you now. It seems pretty unlikely. So better for him to withdraw from consideration. Bigger issue, John Wall having surgery on both knees. The right knee is a pretty minor surgery, but the left knee is a debridement. Sounds like it is a little bit more extensive than you really might prefer. The timetable is he's supposed to be back for next season. Maybe it's unclear. Maybe he could return to basketball activities earlier. But so he will be out of Team USA consideration, which he wouldn't have made anyway. And also may give some indication on why he wasn't quite as good defensively this year. But, you know, this is now a number of knee injuries for Wall. He is starting to get to the age 25 where you begin to lose athleticism. And he also has never really developed as much with his jump shot. He still has great passing vision. He's always going to have that. But if he starts to lose a step, I don't necessarily, I could see him as a guy who's going to peak earlier rather than later, even though he is a big point guard, just because of his lack of a jump shot. Definitely concerning for Wiz fans, especially when they are trying to sell themselves to potential free agents. And John Wall, you know, we're not sure when he's going to be back. I mean, some of the guys who have had these debridement procedures, Anthony Davis has had one. He's going to be out for quite a long time. Carmelo, you remember, had one. He took him quite a while to get back. Those are the two main guys that I recall having them in recent years who are big players. So this could be a setback for him. And he also now is not going to be able to work on that jump shot, which is his biggest limitation all summer.
And that's exactly where I was going to go with this, is that while the long-term things are, of course, more important, off-seasons are pivotal for guys to grow their game and really improve, because you don't get much practice time during the course of a season, especially once you get more into the nitty-gritty. So especially if, let's say, he misses part of camp, that makes it even worse. And so if you can't use that time to get better, then you're also going to have to use camp to get back in shape. And so if he's going to be there, then he's not getting better in terms of a skill standpoint. And when you're 25 and your athleticism is going to start sapping, you need to get better. Everybody does. It's not a criticism of John Wall. It's just a fact of life in the NBA.
Yeah, and as we've talked about before on the show, most players' primes are from 25 to 27. Superstars, there's some evidence that they can elongate that a little bit in general. But from just a pure athleticism standpoint, I think your athletic prime is probably like 22 to 24 when you're just talking about your just pure jumping ability and speed and stuff. So he's probably already a little bit on the downside of that. You know, Blake Griffin is another guy we've seen that's been the case for. But basically anyone in NBA history, you know, you go back and look at like greatest dunks of Vince Carter or LeBron James or Michael Jordan, like most of them happened before they turned 25, even if they weren't the actual best basketball players that they were until maybe a little bit later on from there. So that's sort of what's informing some of that dialogue. For those of you who haven't heard that spiel from me before, over the course of, if you didn't happen to listen to that one of our 230 episodes before. One other small Wizards news thing is their director of player performance / rehabilitation, Thomas Knox, has left to join the St. Louis Cardinals. The Wizards do not have the greatest of health records, so maybe this will lead to some improvements there. You know, always loath to attribute it to you know, inadequacies with the training staff, but they do not have the best health record, and I guess I'll leave it at that. Usually that has something to do with your training staff, at least.
And one of the major developments in the NBA, as the, you know, players only get half of the revenue, and as revenue is going through the roof, is what's going to happen with coaches and training staffs. And we've already seen coaching salaries fly up, and so whether training staffs can really raise their price point because there just aren't as many things for teams to spend money on.
A few other ones that we'll do as quick hitters here before we go. Jarrell Martin, Grizzlies draft pick with the number 25 pick, had two broken feet would indicate it was the same one that he broke twice, right?
He broke his foot twice.
Thank you. He actually now had foot surgery that happened down the end of that Grizzlies series. You know, I think he just probably had still been having issues with it, but you imagine now he'll miss summer league. He's also a guy who doesn't have like the most amazing body composition, had a couple of promising moments for the Grizzlies, but you know, certainly going to be a setback in his bid to earn some more playing time and for the Grizz to actually finally develop a young player of note. Seth Curry is going to opt out in Sacramento, and this is the negative consequence of something that you talked about back during last summer.
Yeah, it's the idea that when you give guys player options, they're always going to make the decision that is less good for the team. That's just the way that it works. And so he did well enough to get out of it, and, you know, he might end up coming back, but he'll, of course, I think he'll expect a raise if he's going to go there. And that's why you don't sign guys to a 1+1 unless they have the leverage to demand it, like a guy like Kevin Durant.
Yeah, and maybe you could say he did. He had a great summer league. I want to say playing for the Pelicans team, and he had some other options. I don't know if any of them were guaranteed for an entire season. He actually had some moments where he looked pretty good down the end of the year, though some of those were kind of some, you know, garbage time April moments that you don't necessarily want to make too much of.
After Carl said he didn't have a future in the league or something to that effect.
Yeah, he's like, oh, he might be an NBA player for like a couple of years or something. But yeah, it's, you know, you're not giving yourself any upside. You know, the point of signing a guy to a minimum contract like that is that you hopefully can get some time on the end. You know, and maybe you could say, you know, I don't know what leverage he had there. And if some other teams were offering him a full year guaranteed as well, maybe that makes sense for why they felt like this was the way to do it. But they also could have offered him like a slight guarantee next year as well and made the second year non-guaranteed or something like that, or even just guaranteed the second year and not given him a player option. Maybe they could have even done that if you really believed in him.
And also,
so now he's going to opt out, and he might actually, with this crappy point guard market, he might actually have some decent suitors.
And you can juxtapose that with like Cole Aldrich and Wesley Johnson, who had real NBA resumes before that and took that with the Clippers, and they got the same offer sheet, and so did Shane Larkin. But I think those guys had proven themselves a lot more than Seth Curry had before this season.
The Kings, however, in a bid to hopefully avoid mistakes of this ilk, have hired Detroit Pistons executive Ken Catinella as their new assistant general manager, and kind of the cap experience that they did not have in their front office roster. I think he actually was involved in creating like NBA.com's stats cube, I think, before he came to the Pistons, a guy who's pretty well regarded, exactly the kind of hire that Sacramento needed. And we'll see what ends up happening there. Another Sacramento news, Eileen Voisin said in an opinion piece that saying the organization should trade Cousins rather than care what the coach says, reported that they at least are now open to considering that. And you know, I said not care what the coach says, not get a coach that, you know, is supposed to pander to him, basically, is what she was saying in that article, but that they might actually consider trading him. So maybe, you know, when those rumors heat up, we can do another whole episode on, like, fake Cousins trades like we did last year.
Yay! And we have to talk about Bosch.
Yeah. He, finally, the Heat organization released a statement saying that he will not be playing again this year and that the mutual focus has been on him returning to play at the soonest possible point. If he never returns, they can apply for a long-term injury exclusion for him that would kick in February of 2017, in which point they would still have to pay him, but he would come off of their books. So for the summer of 2017, they would have, you know, an extra $25 million or so in space. Hopefully that does not happen. Chris Bosh is a great player. We're definitely missing him in this series, that's for sure, from an aesthetic standpoint. But at the very least, the Heat had not released any kind of a statement at all other than to say he's out indefinitely due to privacy laws. They finally got together with Bosh and were able to at least release this mutual statement. And so this at least will be the end of this whole bring Bosh back thing. Some of the tweets that his wife had and, you know, a Snapchat of him shooting and stuff indicating that, you know, he was like ready to play or something. And so they apparently believe that the risk is still there and it just remains to be seen. But you have to think now, after two seasons being ended by this blood clot injury, that they're going to have to kind of proceed for next year on the assumption that he's not going to be around. That could have big consequences for Luol Deng, Hassan Whiteside, anyone who's going to come there. Could be very interesting.
And I think it, personally, I think it's bigger for the players that are considering joining Miami than the players who are already there, because it totally changes the structure of your organization moving forward. Not only because he's a big part of their salary present, you know, maybe not their future, if heaven forbid that that's what happens, but, you know, Dragic is getting older, so they have a lot of money tied up in those two guys. And so if you're, you know, let's say Kevin Durant or somebody like that, it does change the way you think about Miami, because Chris Bosh, when he's healthy, is one hell of a player.
Last one, Deron Williams is reported likely to opt out in Dallas as well. He had, I think, $5.5 million player option. Remember, he's also still getting paid by the Nets most of what would have been his max salary for next season. But he is making the right move by opting out, because it is a pretty weak point guard market. And, you know, as sort of a lower-end starter, high-end backup, I think probably more high-end backup, who may close games, would be a better role for him, because he just keeps breaking down physically. You know, he probably should only be playing maybe like 20, 25 minutes in the regular season. You know, a guy who can also is strong enough to guard some twos, can play off the ball due to his shooting ability. He's still going to be a valued player, and I think he'll easily surpass that $5 million. The question of whether it's going to be in Dallas or not, we don't know, because they will not have, they'll only be able to pay him 120% of last year's salary without eating into their cap space, which they hope to use on some substantial upgrades.
Yeah, for non-bird free agents, which is what he is, they basically structure it so that you don't get much of a benefit for doing that. So I always treat those guys as basically that you're paying them out of cap space anyway. That's just the way I handle it.
All right, that'll do it for today. Danny and I are going to do a little, and some others, doing a little Q&A at the Athletic Bay Area tomorrow, talking about the Warriors series so far and how they've looked since Steph Curry went down, actually writing something. So be sure to check that out. And what else we had to plug in?
I wrote my Kevin Durant piece about how it would fit in with the Spurs. Came out today. It's gotten a good response, which is always fun. And then I will write a Game 3 preview of Warriors Blazers that will be out on The Athletic tomorrow afternoon.
Awesome. Please give us an iTunes review or rating. That is always really helpful. Don't forget about our sponsors, Betterment in this case. Betterment.com/capspace is the URL. And also follow us on Twitter. Of course, live tweeting all the games. Nate Duncan NBA, Dane LaRue as well. We'll talk to you all tomorrow night. We'll be back for a special Friday episode, since we took a day off this week because we wanted to save that episode to go over those two games tomorrow night. Till then.